Hi, everyone. My name's Sebastian Major, and I'm the host of Our Fake History. If you're listening to this, then you're a fan of The Constant. And that means you're someone that likes the weirder corners of history. You enjoy some thoughtful analysis, and most importantly, really great storytelling. Well, if that sounds like you, then you might just like my podcast, Our Fake History. As I'm sure many of you know, the historical record is not always what it seems. It's all too easy for myths, misconceptions, and all-out fabrications to take root in the popular imagination and become what is roundly accepted as quote-unquote real history. On Our Fake History, we dig deep into these historical myths and try to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story it simply must be told. Every 2 weeks, we are either debunking wild historical rumors, like the old chestnut that Queen Elizabeth was really a man, exposing pseudo-histories like the occult fantasies written about the so-called Spear of Destiny, or diving into timeless legends like the Lost City of Atlantis, the Trojan War, or King Arthur to determine whether or not there's a kernel of truth hiding behind the myths. You can find the show at OurFakeHistory.com, or you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or any other podcast app. Now, I turn you over to your capable host, Mr. Mark Chrysler. Enjoy the show.
Normally, at the end of an episode, I include a tag like this.
From Chicago, Illinois, where in 1893, officers at Fort Sheridan spotted a 50-foot-long sea serpent that, quote, caused them to give up drink. This has been The Constant.
Or this. From Chicago, Illinois, where we have our own ever-running bottle prank called Malort. This has been The Constant. Or this.
From that toddling town, Chicago, Illinois. This has been The Constant.
Just little bite-sized nuggets of Chicago history that are meant to put a flourish on the main story. Some of them are interesting, I hope. Some of them are funny, I double hope. And some of them are just, well, sometimes you just gotta land the plane, you know? For this week's episode, though, something surprising happened. A tag began to outgrow itself and swallow up the whole story it was supposed to merely coda. It eventually brought me here. The corner of Dearborn Avenue and Illinois Street, just north of the Chicago River. We call this neighborhood River North, though nobody really knows why. Today, it's packed with gleaming glass towers, hotels, lots of hotels and trendy restaurants, insufferable bars, lots of tourists. But the west side of Dearborn, between Hubbard and Illinois, is a little anomalous. There's a very old stone building that looks kind of like a castle next to a very nondescript firehouse. The stone building is the old Cook County Courthouse. And next to it, where that firehouse now stands, was once the Cook County Jail. This is the site of some of the biggest moments in American legal history. It's here that the alleged Haymarket bombers were tried, sentenced, and executed, touching off a powder keg of American labor unions. This is where Shoeless Joe Jackson and the rest of the so-called Chicago Black Sox were banned from professional baseball in 1921. And it's here that Chicago mobster Sam Cardinelli made what has to be the most audacious, brazen, overcomplicated, and foolhardy escape attempt in the history of all prison breaks. The culmination of a plot hundreds of years in the making. On April 15th, 1921, Sam Cardinelli expected he'd end the day a free man. He just had to die first. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, shocking. Towards the end of In Our Time, his first collection of short stories, Ernest Hemingway breaks up Big Two-Hearted River, a tale of his semi-autobiographical character Nick Adams fishing in Michigan, into parts. And between the two parts, after Nick removes a grasshopper from his sock, but before he dumps 50 of them into a jar, Hemingway makes a curious digression, which he calls merely Chapter 15.
They hanged Sam Cardinella at 6 o'clock in the morning in the corridor of the county jail. The corridor was high and narrow with tiers of cells on either side. All the cells were occupied. The prisoners had been brought in for the hanging. 5 men sentenced to be hanged were in the top 5 cells. 3 of the men to be hanged were Negroes. They were very frightened. One of the white men sat on his cot with his head in his hands. The other lay flat on his cot with a blanket wrapped around his head. They came out onto the gallows through a door in the wall. There were 6 or 7 of them, including 2 priests. They were carrying Sam Cardinella. He had been like that since 4 o'clock in the morning. While they were strapping his legs together, 2 guards held him up and 2 priests were whispering to him. "Be a man, my son," said one priest. When they came toward him with the cap to go over his head, Sam Cardinella lost control of his sphincter muscles. The guards who had been holding him up dropped him. They were both disgusted. "How about a chair, Will?" asked one of the guards. "Better get one," said a man in a derby hat. When they all stepped back on the scaffolding back of the drop, which was very heavy, built of oak and steel and swung on ball bearings, Sam Cardinella was left sitting there, strapped tight with the rope around his neck. The younger of the 2 priests kneeling beside the chair, holding up a little crucifix. The priest skipped back onto the scaffolding just before the drop fell.
Hemingway wasn't there to see the hanging of Sam Cardinella. He'd only read about it in the papers. But the point he had taken away was the same one that newsreaders across the nation had, that a cold-hearted murderer, the toughest of tough guys, had trembled, collapsed, and shit himself when it came time to take a taste of his own medicine. Not a bad little moral. Only problem is, Hemingway, along with everyone else, had been fooled. The crying, the trembling, the collapsing, even the defecating, was all a ruse, a part of the ultimate escape plan. The initial spark of that plan traces back to the 1770s, where 2 of Enlightenment science's most difficult questions were coming to a head. The first question was also one of the most basic and fundamental parts of biology. How do living things move? Since the Greeks, people understood that it must have something to do with muscles, but how did muscles themselves work? In the 2nd century AD, philosopher and physician Galen, who we talked about way back in Let's Talk About Sex, Babies, provided the solution that would stand as common wisdom for the next millennium and a half. Galen proposed that muscles must be inflated and deflated by some sort of fluid or vapor, like the hydraulics of an animatronic robot. This seemed reasonable enough, and was accepted as basically a known fact up until Jan Swammerdam, who also featured in Let's Talk About Sex, Babies, came along. Swammerdam was tormented by a conflict between his Christian faith, which taught him not to concern himself with matters of the flesh, and his greatest fleshly, earthly desire, bugs. He couldn't help but study, experiment, and investigate insects, and he cursed this as a love lust that endangered his immortal spirit. In the course of his self-supposed immoral hobby, Swammerdam made a number of important discoveries. He worked out the phases of insect life, egg, larva, pupa, adult. He found that caterpillars contained the limbs and wings of the butterflies they'd eventually become. He figured out that king bees were really queen bees. He discovered red blood cells. And in 1667, he demonstrated that Galen's theory of muscular movement, called, adorably, balloonism, was wrong. Unlike most of his bugly work, Swammerdam conducted his balloonism experiments on frogs. And I should say now that if you've got a problem with frogs being experimented on, this is not the episode for you. Like, seriously, if that is your particular bugaboo, this episode is practically laboratory designed to kryptonite you. So, that is your warning. Swammerdam cut out the thigh muscle of a frog, see, I told you, and put it into a syringe with a bit of water. He cut a small hole in the head of the syringe, which he could pull the nerve of the muscle through, and sealed the whole thing up. The idea here was that he could now irritate the nerve, which would cause the muscle to contract, which, if the blueness were right, would make the muscle swell up, which he'd be able to see as the water level in the syringe rose. But it didn't. In fact, when Swammerdam made the muscle move, he noticed that the water level dropped a tiny bit. There was no way that the muscle could be filling up with anything. In 1685, the exiled Catholic ex-queen of Sweden, Christina, helped publish De Motu Animalium by her similarly exiled friend and ally Giovanni Borelli, who had died penniless in 1679. In De Motu, Borelli described an experiment he conducted whereby he had slit open the muscles of various animals underwater and had shown that no air was released. Balloonism was wrong. But, in that case, how did muscles move? That takes us to the second question, the one that nearly every scientist in the 1770s was trying to figure out. It's a two-parter, really. A. What is electricity? And B. What the hell good is it? Probably humanity had been playing with electricity since prehistory, in the form of magnets or lightning or electric eels or torpedo fish. The Greeks pretty definitely understood that you could rub amber with fur and then pick up bits of stuff or reach out and give someone a shock. And that's about where things stood for the next couple thousand years, picking up feathers with amber. Yet, there was obviously something really big here, some deep mystery. When the great thinkers of history, like Augustine, Pliny, Plato, Galileo, stopped to consider it, they would shortly realize that they were on the brink of a yawning problem. But then, it seems, almost all of them would eventually forget about it and move on to other things. Even those scientists who made the first major advances in electricity don't appear to have understood what they were doing, or that it might be important. In 1705, Francis Hauksbee, Isaac Newton's head of demonstrations to London's Royal Academy, showed off a cool new trick he'd been noodling with. He took a glass sphere, pumped the air out of it, and pushed a rotating spit through it. He turned the handle on the spit, and the glass ball began spinning faster and faster. Then Hauksbee urged the members of the Academy who were watching to snuff out their candles. In the dark, Hauksbee lowered his free hand onto the spinning globe, and almost immediately, something unprecedented happened. An eerie blue light formed along the inner edge of the glass, licking and reaching, like it was trying to get out and into Hauksbee's fingers. It sparked like lightning and undulated like fire. It was bright enough for Hauksbee to read by, and bright enough that all the scientific minds of London could see it. 50 or so years earlier, Otto von Guericke, the German polymath who invented the air pump, had done something similar. But his sphere was opaque, made out of sulfur, so all he could do with it was pick up more feathers. What Hauksbee was up to was bigger. He was showing a way to manually manufacture electricity. That's a big wow moment, if there ever was one. Except, no. The hall agreed it was a very neat little trick, and Hauksbee was satisfied that his device had worked as planned, but that was it. Nobody, not Hauksbee or any of the members of the Royal Society or even the great Isaac Newton himself, understood that this was anything more than a fun novelty. And consequently, the next 40 years of electrical innovation fell into the hands not of sober-minded scientists, but of performers and entertainers and other sundry castouts. They called themselves electricians, and they made their way as party magicians, or at side tents or expos. They'd pick up feathers and chaff, deliver little jolts to dinner guests. Stephen Gray, a down-on-his-luck silk dyer, put on a show at the halfway house that housed him, suspending a boy on a silk swing, charging him with a Hauksbee machine, and swinging him over flecks of chaff and paper that shot up onto his hands and face. Through this demo, Gray figured out conductivity and made a pretty impression on his audience. A German electrician, George Matthias Bose, used Hauksbee's machine to even more dramatic effect. He had several signature tricks. For the first, he'd invite an attractive young woman up from the crowd and onto a slab of resin. Then he'd spool up his Hawksbee machine and instruct the young woman to run a metal bar in her hands over it. After she was sufficiently electrically charged, Bose would invite another volunteer, usually a young man, up to the stage. Bose would then ask his two marks to kiss, and as the stranger's lips lasciviously touched, the circuit would complete and a shock of electricity would travel between them. In the increasingly inquisitive and increasingly prudish 18th century, watching two young, unmarried strangers kiss amid sparks of the new mystery force was very popular. Soon, Bose's electric kiss was a standard part of the routine for electricians everywhere. More dramatic still was electrical beatification, where Bose would sit a volunteer on an insulated throne, complete with a metal crown beneath his Hawksbee generator. When he revved it up, sparks would fly and create a magnificent halo above the wearer, like a painted Renaissance angel. But it was a smaller trick of Bose's that ended up providing the, spark for the electrical revolution. Bose would charge himself up and extend his finger over a cup of alcohol layered on top of water. The spark would appear to leap from his fingertip, igniting the alcohol. Enlightenment Europe consistently undervalued electrical discoveries, but this was to them something more major. Fire from water. The paradox of it intrigued thinkers from Germany to England to the small Baltic nation of Pomerania, where a Lutheran pastor named Ewald George von Kleist got a wild idea. Part of what had, up until von Kleist, limited the usefulness of, and hence interest in, electricity was that you had to make it on the spot with Hawksbee's spinning glass globe, and then use up whatever you produced pretty much right away. Gray and Bose and the rest of the electricians of Europe described electricity as a fluid, but if that was right, why couldn't you store it in something? Von Kleist heard about Bose's fire from water trick and thought maybe it held the key. He filled a glass bottle with alcohol, sealed it with a cork, and then stuck a metal nail through that cork. Then he picked the bottle up by hand, put the nail against the business end of his Hawksbee machine, and charged it up. When he snuffed out the candles in the room, he could see that telltale blue glow within. Amazed, von Kleist, while holding the bottle, touched the nail with his free hand, and von Kleist got a shock that sent him flying across the room, dropping and breaking the jar. Ewald George von Kleist had just invented the first electric capacitor and immediately broken it. He was so shaken by the shock that he was never able to make one again. But he wrote to some old friends from college at the University of Leiden and told them about his shocking experiment. A number of folks at Leiden then began toying with their own electrified alcohol vessels, and in 1746, Professor Pieter von Muschenbroek succeeded in replicating, and taking credit for, the first electrical capacitor, called the Leiden jar. The Leiden jar was a game changer, and news of its invention spread at lightning speed across the world. Within 5 years, people throughout all of Europe, Asia, and North Africa had a way to store a huge electrical charge, much stronger than what the electricians had been producing with their Hawksbee machines, for days or even weeks. Suddenly, electricity wasn't a parlor trick anymore. It was an undeniably important phenomenon that demanded the attention of inventors, thinkers, and scientists everywhere. Except, even now, nobody had a blooming clue what it was or what you could do with it. It was evident to everyone that there was potential way beyond delivering electric kisses here, but damned if anybody could figure out what it was. So, for the next 40 years, people just started electrocuting any old thing they could think of. There was plenty of progress made. It was in this period that Benjamin Franklin figured out that lightning was electricity, although let's clear something up right now. He never flew a kite in a thunderstorm. He was smart enough to know that was a stupid idea, and smart enough to realize that the story of it would be very memorable. Oh, Benji, you rascal. God, how I love you. More important than lightning, Franklin worked out how Leiden jars worked. That electricity depended upon a positive and a negative charge. Credit and debit, as he said, and that an electrical charge happened when a circuit was completed that let the two balance out. That still didn't totally explain what the hell this charge was, though, much less what was to be done with it. So people kept shocking stuff. And one of the things they tried shocking was, and I already warned you about this, frogs. Luigi Galvani was a quiet, introverted, devoutly religious man. He was born, lived, and died in Bologna, which was arguably a quiet, introverted, and deeply religious city. And he was educated at the quiet, introverted, and deeply religious University of Bologna, where he studied medicine, surgery, and philosophy. He graduated in 1761 and was almost immediately brought on as an anatomist and lecturer, and married his wife, Lucia Galeazzi, the daughter of his professor, anatomist Domenico Guzmano Galeazzi. When Domenico died in 1775, Galvani stepped up into his chair, a full professor and member of the Academy of Sciences. As part of his membership, Galvani was required to produce and publish a new scientific paper every year. So, in his father-in-law's former lab, Galvani and Lucia began conducting experiments together, initially focusing on the anatomy of the auditory systems of animals, but eventually they, too, like nearly everyone else, became interested in electricity. The legend of the first Galvani frog experiment is as unlikely to be true as it is irresistible to retell. That Galvani and an assistant were skinning a frog for some other experiment at his lab where he and Lucia had been playing with static electricity the night before. One of the scalpels had, unbeknownst to Galvani, become electrically charged, and when his assistant accidentally touched one of the de-skinned nerves with it, the dead frog's leg kicked. Like I say, almost certainly didn't happen that way. Galvani most likely shocked the poor ex-frog's nerve on purpose. He'd seen a demonstration at the university when he was still a student back in 1759, where a Leyden jar had been liberally applied to the limbs of a quadriplegic. Two stunning result. But the actual meat and potatoes of the experiment, exposed frog nerve, electrical shock, kicking leg, that part is definite. And it's the part where our two questions, how do animals move, and what good is electricity, converged. And maybe this is a good time to reassure you that, yes, all appearance to the contrary, this is, in fact, still the story of a 1921 Chicago jailbreak. Galvani repeated his twitching frog experiment over and over and concluded that he had discovered the true method of locomotion, animal electricity. There was, he said, a special kind of electricity that lived inside the brains and bodies of animals, and that special animal electricity was the thing that traveled through nerves and into muscles, animating all life. Galvani's ideas spread quickly, bolstered by his electrified frog experiment, which had the benefit of being easily reproducible. Any scientist in the world could skin a frog, expose its nerves, charge up their Hawksbee machine, and see for themselves that Galvani was right. That was the plan, at least. But one of the first to replicate his procedure threw a wrench in things. The city of Como is just 140 miles from Bologna, as the crow flies. But in the 1790s, they were worlds apart. Where Bologna was conservative and staunchly Catholic, Como was a part of the Austrian Empire, the beating heart of the Enlightenment, seeking new ideas, new inventions, and new modes of thinking. And if Luigi Galvani epitomized the nature of Bologna, Alessandro Volta was the avatar of Como. Young, brash, boisterous, Volta was known for being a Lothario, a loudmouth, an agnostic, and, most importantly, a genius. He was born into a sort of frayed nobility, all hat, no cattle. His family had a name, titles, and land, but not a lot of money. When Alessandro was 7, his father died, leaving a pile of uncollected debts behind him. In order to get him an education, his uncle admitted him to a Jesuit school, which was free, under the condition that he use his learning to become a priest. But Volta didn't like religion. He wanted to study electricity. And boy, did he. When he was 20, he wrote his first paper on the subject, about generating static electricity by rubbing stuff together, and sent it to one of the foremost scholars on the subject, Giambattista Beccaria. 4 years later, he worked out how static electricity works at a distance. In 1775, he independently invented the electrophorus, essentially a more advanced, powerful, and reliable version of Hauksbee's machine. More than a decade earlier, a Swedish professor named Vilke had created basically the same machine, but Volta didn't know that, and Volta's worked a lot better. A year later, fascinated by Benjamin Franklin's writings on flammable air, Volta managed to isolate and identify methane, which he then exploded via electric spark, the same process that would eventually lead to the internal combustion engine. Fast forward to 1781, and Volta is knocking on 40 years old, the chair of experimental physics at the University of Pavia, a fellow at the Royal Society of London, the inventor of roughly a dozen important electrical machines, and the most important and intimidating mind on all things electric. So when Volta heard that Galvani had sparked a dead frog into moving, he had to see it for himself. Volta became one of the first people to reproduce Galvani's findings when he managed to get his own frog leg a-jumpin'. But instead of validating the Bolognian's theory, he challenged it. Let's get that premise out again. You take the frog, expose a nerve, shock that nerve, and the leg twitches. This happened, according to Galvani, because there was an intrinsic, special, animal electricity in the frog, which the spark encouraged to flow. But when Volta saw the dead frog jump, he said, wait a second, where's this animal electricity jazz coming from? To Volta, the simplest explanation for the frog twitch was that the electricity from the Hauksbee machine was doing the work, and he didn't see why you had to introduce some other form of electricity into things at all. These were the terms of one of the greatest and most important scientific rivalries of all time. Did the frog move because of a special animal electricity, or because of the regular old spark of the Hauksbee machine? Galvani said it was the former, because otherwise it would mean that the essence of life, God's most profound and holy contribution to creation, was nothing more than the thing you got from rubbing your slippers on the carpet and touching a doorknob. Maybe that sounded fine to some garish, womanizing Austrian agnostic, but Galvani knew better. There had to be a different, unapproachable life force. All he had to do was prove it. But how? Easy enough, really. If he could simply make a frog twitch again, but this time without the help of an artificial spark, he'd show the world that there was a divine energy at work. And Volta, the heretical peacock who embarrassed him by questioning his conclusions, would be put in his proper place. Which was hell, I think. Yeah, I think it was hell. Think of all the poor froggies that paid the price of Galvani's quest over the next few years. We don't know what precisely their corpses were subjected to, but it's safe to say a lot of crazy-ass stuff. Or everything that didn't work, and one thing that did. That's right. Galvani did eventually succeed. Whatever chain of experiments and hypotheses brought him there, he ultimately chanced upon a setup that worked. He hung an iron wire, like a clothesline, across his lab space, and hung his dead frogs from it, like linens. Then, he tied a copper wire to the iron one, and touched the end of it to the hanging frog nerve. Voila! It moved. No Hauksbee machine, no Leyden jar, no outside artificial form of electricity required. With just a couple of mundane metal wires, Galvani had managed to coax the animal electricity out of the frogs again, and proved himself, and God, let's not forget God, right. In 1786, Galvani, triumphant, published his results and his newly bolstered theory. There was electricity, and there was animal electricity. As a big old fuck you, he sent a copy of his new book directly to Volta. Volta, as you can guess, didn't like that very much. But he was stumped. He believed that Galvani was wrong, that animal electricity was just religious superstition. But then, what was up with this new experiment? He couldn't explain it. He had a suspicion, though. The metal wires. Fast forward a few years, and Volta is engaged in what seems like a very silly experiment. Licking money. Like you do. He finds that when he puts a copper coin in his mouth, it tastes, unsurprisingly, like copper. And when he puts an iron coin in his mouth, it also unremarkably tastes like iron. But when he puts a copper coin and an iron coin in there, he gets a new third taste, a tingly taste. Volta recognizes it. It's the taste of electricity. Somehow, he thinks the different metals are interacting on his tongue and creating electricity, and that must be the same thing that caused Galvani's clothesline frogs to move. But how could he prove it? If, indeed, there was an electric charge at work here, it was too small and weak to conclusively measure. To finally put an end to the idea of animal electricity, Volta would need to make the coin taste a lot stronger. And to do that, he'd need some help from a fish. While Volta and Galvani fought it out in Italy, the same basic argument was happening in England between Henry Cavendish and himself. Cavendish had worked out that the fearsome bite of the torpedo fish was actually an electric shock, but he couldn't be sure of whether it was the same kind of electricity as in a Leyden jar, like Volta was arguing, or if it were a unique sort of intrinsic electricity to the fish, like Galvani believed. So he published his results without saying. Whether it was animal or not, the torpedo bite was electric. While trying to work out a way to magnify his electric coin effect, Volta pored over Cavendish's research and took a big, long look at his drawings of the torpedo. He saw that the area that seemed to produce the fish's shock was actually made up of tons of little flat cells piled on top of one another, and had a revelation. Maybe the immense charge had to do with having all of these tiny electrocytes working together in concert. And maybe he could build his own artificial torpedo fish out of his tingly pocket change. Volta took a flat copper plate, topped it with a paper disc soaked in dilute acid, and then topped that with a flat iron plate. This metal and acid sandwich was, he figured, principally the same as the coins in his mouth, the frog on the wires, and one of the torpedo fish cells. Then he made another sandwich and plopped it on top of the first, and then another, and another, and another, into a big pile of rotating copper, acid, iron, copper, acid, iron. Then he connected a wire to the top of the pile, another to the bottom, and this was one of the biggest moments in human history. The charge issuing from Volta's pile wasn't just another version of Hauksbee's machine, mechanically producing a static charge. This was chemical, the world's first electric battery. There was another difference, too, a big, big difference. Up until Volta struck the wires together on his pile, people had only ever managed to create a spark. A quick, almost instantaneous static charge. But the pile was continuous. The electricity just kept coming and coming, pouring out of the pile like a river, like a stream, like a current. The implications of the voltaic pile were gigantic. All that time spent wondering what the hell electricity was good for? Well, that was over now. In a matter of months after the voltaic pile was revealed, people were using it to run a current through water, separating oxygen from hydrogen. Within a few years, Humphrey Davy created an electric arc light in front of the Royal Society. Electric motors, the light bulb, the modern world itself was all within reach the moment Volta struck his wires together. Yet for him, the most important part of his discovery was that it totally fucked Luigi Galvani. Hey Galvani, you hear that? You know what that sound is? It's the sound of animal electricity dying. What do you say to that, Luigi? Goaded Volta. And Galvani said nothing. His best friend, collaborator, and wife, Lucia, died in 1790, and Napoleon had taken over his beloved Bologna in 1796. Because he refused to swear allegiance to Napoleon, he was stripped of his professorship, his prosperity, his property, and, finally, his health. And then, Volta had destroyed his legacy and rocked his faith. Broke, alone, heartbroken, and depressed, he died in his brother's house on December 4th, 1798. Galvani gave up and sadly died. But his science of bioelectricity, which Volta named galvanism in honor of his rival, wasn't done yet. Upon Galvani's passing, his nephew, Giovanni Aldini, stepped up into his footsteps, succeeding him as professor of physics at Bologna. And Aldini's primary interest was vindicating and expanding the work of his uncle. Aldini believed in Galvani's animal electricity, and he had a hunch that he could take things further than twitching frog legs. With the power of the voltaic pile, Aldini set about trying to raise the dead. Carting a giant electric battery from town to town and country to country, Aldini would make public demonstrations of the power continuous current had over the dead, causing the tails of dead dogs to wag and the tongues of dead bulls to lick. These displays were gruesome, captivating, and amazing. But they were nothing compared to what Aldini planned to do when he got to London in 1803. This episode of The Constant is brought to you by the Whatever Happened To series for the young and easily influenced. Envision a future where our most popular children's books are written by today's Tommy Lawrence, Dennis Prager's, and Carl Rose. It may sound horrible, but the creators of the Whatever Happened To series have made it hilarious. Like Rolling Together 1984 and Everyone Poops, the Whatever Happened To series makes parody books that boil down for future generations whatever happened to insects, Mexican food, nipples, even colonoscopies, and explains away the end of the world in the most simplistic, unscientific, and frankly made-up terms. Right now, for listening to the show, the Whatever Happened To series is giving you two free ebooks, no strings attached. Like seriously, just go to www.whateverhappenedtoseries.com/constant and you can see for yourself how funny, weird, and absolutely brilliant this series is for yourself. And while you're there, you can name your own price for the rest of the ebooks and designate how much of that money you want to go to a philanthropic cause, like the ACLU or the Violence Policy Center. For those who have discovered John Oliver's Marlon Brando or Stephen Colbert's Whose Boat Is This Boat, the Whatever Happened To series is your next step into the future. Go now, give them a read. I absolutely love these books, and I'm 87% certain you will too. The link, again, for your two free downloads is www.whateverhappenedtoseries.com/constant, or find it in the episode notes right now. All right, back to the show. On January 14th, 1803, George Forster was brought before a jury at London's Old Bailey. There, Jane Hobart testified that her daughter and infant grandchild, who lived with her in Old Boswell Court, had left the home on December 4th for the purpose of visiting Forster, their husband and father, respectively. Jane said that from then, she never again saw her daughter or the baby, nor did she receive any word of their fates or whereabouts until they were found, drowned, in Paddington Canal. Joseph Bradfield, who rented a room to George Forster, testified that he'd seen him, along with wife and daughter, on the night of the 4th, and again the next morning, Sunday, when they went out together at around 10 a.m. Bradfield testified that the couple appeared to be on bad terms, owing from her desire to live with her husband and his resistance to that arrangement. When George returned around 9 that night, he was alone. The tavern keeper of the Spotted Dog near Paddington Canal, Eleanor Winter, swore under oath that she had served beefsteak, beer, and brandy to the three Sunday morning, and that she had noticed the woman crying. Another tavern keeper, John Goff, also related having served the three rum and porter a few hours after they'd left the Spotted Dog, and said that when they left, they headed down an obscure, unmarked trail towards the water. Finally, a 9-year-old girl, Sarah Daniels, was called to the stand, where she told the jury she had met a man following a woman and child near the canal somewhere around 5. For the defense's part, they called several character witnesses, as well as George Forster's statement itself, in which he said he had parted ways with his wife and child directly after leaving the second pub and walked his way 7 or so miles up to Whetstone to visit his 2 other children, who were employed in a workhouse there. The chief baron said it was impossible for Forster to have covered the distance he claimed in the time available, and gave his case over to the jury, that George Forster, angered by his wife's insistence on joining him in his living situation, did drown her and his infant child in the Paddington Canal. It was a decidedly weak and circumstantial case, but the jury quickly delivered a guilty verdict, and the recorder passed sentence. George Forster was to be hanged by the neck until he be dead, and that then his body be delivered to be anatomized according to the law in that case made and provided. Before his punishment was meted out, George Forster confessed to having hated his wife and having brought her to Paddington Canal with the intention of drowning her on two separate occasions before the murder, each time having lost his nerve before finally finding it again on the third attempt. The report from Newgate Prison describes him as melancholic and wan, haunted by a tortured conscience that enfeebled him, such that he had to be carried from his cell to the gallows. Then he was hanged, as per the sentence, until he was dead. There's a good amount of reason to doubt the fairness of George Forster's verdict, or at least the facts of his guilt. Several acquaintances to his wife and victim described her as suicidal, and there's some testimony, which the court ignored, that attested to Forster having made his way to a pub in Whetstone. Some have argued his post-trial confession was coerced, a pretty reasonable theory in any time and place, let alone early 19th century London. And some have argued that Forster had been railroaded from investigation to trial to execution, that various officials had been bribed or otherwise corrupted, all because Giovanni Aldini was in town, and Giovanni Aldini wanted a fresh body. The Newgate Calendar relates that Forster, quote, died very easy, and after hanging the usual time, his body was cut down and conveyed to a house not far distant, where it was subjected to the galvanic process by Professor Aldini. Aldini, armed with his uncle's theories and his rival's technology, was able to cause George Forster's cold fist to clench, his glassy eyes to open, his dead mouth to smile, all before a stunned and enraptured audience. The reporting of the time says that one witness to the demonstration was so shocked that he went home after it concluded and promptly died from the fright. That same reporting rolled its eyes at the commoners who thought Aldini was bringing the convicted murderer back to life. In the 200 and some years since Aldini partially reanimated George Forster's corpse, a lot has been written about how people mistook the experiment as an attempt at resurrection. But those people were not mistaken. Aldini didn't believe he could bring Forster back to life. His spine had been broken by the noose, after all. But the purpose of his display was to prove that he could bring back others. Let's take a minute to think about the point at which a thing goes from being alive to dead. It's a sticky wicket of a question. Today we have machines that can keep the heart beating and the lungs breathing even when there is no brain activity left. And we call people in such a state dead, or brain dead. That is, in the most literal view, wrong. The cells of such patients are as alive as yours or mine, but we recognize that human life, as we value it, is in the mind. And if there is no mind, there is no true life. What's important to note about this definition of death is that it depends entirely upon the technology available to us, diagnostic and clinical. Without MRIs and EEGs and CT scans, there would be no way to mark death via the brain. And without a way to mechanically govern the heart and lungs, there'd be no reason for us to draw a distinction between the failure of one organ and the others. Before all those tools became available, there was the stethoscope, which was invented in 1816 by René Laennec. It came into common usage between the 1830s and 50s, and with it came a new definition of death for that time, heart death. But before that, for almost all people, in all places and times, the way to determine whether someone was alive or dead came down to one question. Are they breathing? Take Shakespeare, for example.
Howl, 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 howl!
This is King Lear, and in Act 5, Scene 3, he enters very upset with his favored daughter, Cordelia, limp in his arms.
Oh, you are men of stones. Had I your tongues and eyes, I'd use them so that heaven's vault should crack. She's gone forever.
But wait, how does he know she's really dead?
I know when one is dead and when one lives. She's dead as earth. Lend me a looking glass. If that her breath will mist or stain the stone, why, then she lives.
If her breath appears on a mirror, she lives. But there is no mirror, so Lear picks up a feather and touches it to her mouth.
This feather stirs, she lives. If it be so, it is a chance which does redeem all sorrows that ever I have felt.
But there is no stirring of the feather.
I might have saved her. Now she's gone forever. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? Thou'lt come no more. Never, 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 never!
The breath is the life. For Shakespeare, for the Talmud and the Torah and the Bible and the Quran. And why shouldn't it be? Without the CT scan and the MRI and the heart-lung machine, without defibrillators and adrenaline and epinephrine, without the stethoscope, there was no way and no reason to relate death to the brain or the heart. But for all of human existence, there had been a clear corollary fact. When someone stopped breathing, they didn't start again. Until 1767, when a group of concerned and curious upper-crust friends in Amsterdam formed the Society for Recovery of Drowned Persons. The Society eventually laid out a number of recommendations for how to resuscitate a drowning victim. Some of these recommendations were better than others. For instance, they urged people to fill a bellows with tobacco smoke and fumigate the victim's anus with it, which is probably not a fantastic idea. But they also encouraged people to warm the body, to clear the airway, to apply pressure to the abdomen, and, most importantly, to deliver breath to the patient, mouth to mouth. Within a few years, hundreds of lives were saved, and the word of the process was spread far and wide across the world. Mouth to mouth was a game changer for first aid and lifeguarding. But it also deeply challenged everyone's understanding of death. Imagine if, instead of asking for a mirror, Lear had said,
I know when one is dead and when one lives. She's dead as earth. Lend me a bellows. If that it brings back her breath, why, then she lives again. Come on, Cordelia. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Stay with me now.
Hey, Dad.
Cordelia? Cordelia?
We know that this is resuscitation.
Hey, how you feeling?
We know that we're not returning someone from death, but preventing the death.
Hey, honey, you look good.
The people of the late 18th and early 19th century, however, had no such understanding. It appeared to them that the drowned were being resurrected, leaving for beyond the veil of life for one, two, even 5 or 6 minutes before being pulled back, mechanically, to mortality. Death was, it seemed, not as terminal as it had been assumed to be. As science progressed, how much dead time might we be able to reverse? An hour? A day? A year? Maybe we might someday find that death is entirely and perpetually reversible. That, in the end, there is no end at all. That was the hypothesis Giovanni Aldini tested on George Forster in 1803. And, as far as many were concerned, the test was a stirring success. After he caused the mouth to smile, the eye to open, the fist to clench, Aldini delivered the coup de grace. He inserted his voltaic probe into George Forster's anus, and the whole of the dead man's body sprang to, well, life, if you'd forgive the phrase. His arms flung out from side to side, his legs kicked, his back arched, and, so said the onlookers, he appeared to draw a shocked and pained breath. It was no wonder people walked away thinking Forster had perhaps been brought back to life. By the only definition open to them, he had been. This is all starting to sound a little familiar, isn't it? kind of like this.
Look, it's moving. It's alive.
We've already explored one angle of the Genesis. Is that a pun? I hope not. Of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, back in the episode Diabolical Devices of the Demon of Darkness. But more crucial than the eruption of Mount Tambora was the eruption of stories about galvanic resurrection. Shelley herself wrote that she was inspired by Aldini's experiment on Forster. But that wasn't the only place she could have drawn inspiration from. Not long after Aldini's macabre London death show, a German state scientist named Carl August Weinhold said that he had... Wait, let's pause another second. If you didn't like the frog experiments, you're really going to hate this one. How do you feel about kittens? Kittens? You like them? If so, maybe fast forward 45 seconds or so. If Aldini was Dr. Frankenstein, Weinhold was Dr. Evil. His most infamous idea came from 1827, where he wrote up his solution for overpopulation and masturbation, soldering the foreskin of unmarried men closed over the head of the penis. But before he came up with that very pleasant plan, he claimed to have decapitated a kitten, pulled out its spinal cord, and replaced it with a voltaic pile. According to Weinhold, he managed in his fashion not only to restart the headless kitten's heart, but to get it to leap around for 15 minutes. He then repeated the experiment, this time by scooping out a kitten's brain and replacing that with a battery, which he said brought the cat back even more fully. For 20 minutes, it looked around, crawled, and finally rose and walked about the laboratory. I know, it's pretty gruesome. But if it makes you feel better, Weinhold was almost certainly lying. In 1818, at the same time Shelley was inventing her fictional mad doctor, the Scottish physician Andrew Ure was sticking an electrified wire up the nose of recently executed murderer Matthew Clydesdale, stimulating his phrenic nerve. Here's Ure's description of what happened.
Every muscle of the body was immediately agitated with convulsive movements resembling a violent shuddering from cold. On moving the second rod from hip to heel, the knee being previously bent, the leg was thrown out with such violence as nearly to overturn one of the assistants, who in vain tried to prevent its extension. The body was also made to perform the movements of breathing by stimulating the phrenic nerve and the diaphragm. When the supraorbital nerve was excited, every muscle in his countenance was simultaneously thrown into fearful action. Rage, horror, despair, anguish, and ghastly smiles united their hideous expressions in the murderer's face, surpassing far the wildest representations of Fuseli or Akeem. At this period, several of the spectators were forced to leave the apartment from terror or sickness, and one gentleman fainted.
According to Ure, Clydesdale even stood up, and, lacking a better alternative, Ure eventually stabbed him in the throat to put an end to his grisly experiment. In short, there were a bevy of mad scientists running around the early 19th century to influence Mary Shelley. They weren't just idiots shocking things for the fun of it, though. Aldini managed to show his uncle was more right than Volta's research had shown. There was no special kind of animal electricity, sure, but Aldini proved that it was electricity produced in animals that powered locomotion. And while history mostly remembers him for his experiments on George Forster, if it remembers him at all, his most productive work was done on Luigi Lorenzini, a melancholic farmhand who Aldini managed to shock out of his depressive stupor with a bolt to the head. And Andrew Ure's experiments got him within a hair's breadth of discovering defibrillation. Instead, he was caught up in an adulterous divorce scandal between his wife and a fellow professor. He gave up his chair at the Andersonian and moved from Edinburgh to London, where he instead focused on writing about how 19th century factory owners were really swell folks and union workers were evil. No one at the time recognized the discovery of electroconvulsive therapy or defibrillation because by 1830, the whole enterprise of galvanism was beyond resuscitation itself. There are probably a few causes of death. For one, all these morbid and distasteful experiments weren't really getting anywhere. Nobody had managed to restart a heart in the last 30 years of trying, but they had managed to gross out the public with all their electric anal probes and seizuring corpses. Moreover, the corpses themselves were a matter of contention. There was a general sense of outrage with all the grave robbing that was going on to provide these suspect scientists with specimens. The men employed to steal bodies for universities and hospitals were called resurrectionists, and the opprobrium around their profession finally hit a fever pitch when, in 1828, two Scottish resurrectionists, William Burke and William Hare, were found to have murdered 16 people in order to keep Dr. Robert Knox well-stocked. Yet, maybe the real killing blow for galvanic resurrection was delivered by Mary Shelley and her novel itself. When Shelley wrote her famous book, she probably didn't consider it very far-fetched, but the story she told and the characterization of its doctor and monster had a profound effect on people's thinking about this newfangled so-called science. After reading Frankenstein, people no longer pictured the promise of galvanic resurrection reviving the drowned or retrieving lost loved ones. They thought of hideous, soulless, murderous beasts from beyond the grave. And that was some very bad PR. So that was it. The end. No more creepy doctors playing with electrical batteries and executed convicts. Except one more. The Constant is brought to you by Industrial Artifacts. I have a recurring daydream where I inexplicably discover an extra room behind the closet I'm recording in. It's my own personal office, and in my fantasies, it is glorious. There's a fine leather Regency armchair and ottoman for me to kick up on while I'm reading. There's a 100-year-old pull-down map cabinet on the wall so I can stare purposelessly at the continental U.S. or Illinois circa 1908, and then do that thing where I let the map snap, roll up, and disappear the way I got in trouble for in elementary school. And center stage, there's the desk. An antique, quarter-sawn oak draftsman's desk. Dark and woody and wonderful, with more than a dozen pull-out drawers for all my miscellaneous doodads and nonsense. In my dreams, it's perfect. And every last element can be found at Industrial Artifacts. They've got more than 20,000 square feet chock-block with vintage lighting, seating, tables, advertising, and other found objects. Whether you're outfitting a hip new bar, searching for that fabulous kitchen table, or, sigh, building out your non-existent home office space, Industrial Artifacts has you covered. And right now, Industrial Artifacts is offering Constant listeners 15% off their entire first order. Just enter coupon code THECONSTANT at checkout. Check out the link in the episode notes or go to industrialartifacts.net today. And remember to enter coupon code THECONSTANT, one word, to get 15% off your first order. One day, pull down map. One day. Here we are, back again at the old Cook County Courthouse. But we're not ready to talk about Sam Cardinale yet. First, we've got to step back in time to September 15th, 1882. That morning, James Tracy awoke, chipper and cheerful. He had eggs and two shots of whiskey for breakfast, smoked a cigar, and wrote some letters. He waved goodbye to his friends, the young men he'd spent last night talking and playing cards with, the old men who gave him respectful nods. Then, he walked up to the gallows at the old Cook County Courthouse, gave the noose a tug, and remarked brightly to the assembled crowd, "I think it'll hold me." On February 3rd, somebody broke into a grocery store, stealing a clock and a vest while his lookouts kept watch. Across the street, Thomas Henning saw what was going on and fired a shot at the burglars, who shot back before making a hasty getaway. All the gunfire attracted police attention. The cops gave chase and cornered three men in an alley on Noble Street. This led to a second shootout, in which one of the officers was shot. The bandits got away, and Officer Hubner died in bed of his injuries the next day. A few days later, a jailhouse informant fingered James Tracy for the crime. The fuzz tracked Tracy to a bar at Canal and Adams, where Tracy again made a run for it and again fired upon his pursuers. But he was quickly apprehended. At trial, it took the jury just 3 minutes to convict him, and the next day he was sentenced to be hanged at the old jail next to the courthouse, now that nondescript firehouse amid the hotels and high-rises. Tracy maintained his innocence all the way. When he was finally walked up to the noose after lunch, his casual demeanor gave way, and he began to tremble and well up. When asked if he had any final words, he replied, "Yeah, I do. I have no statement to make further than the fact that I am innocent. In a few moments, I shall stand before my Maker. Were any man under these circumstances guilty, he would acknowledge it. Innocent as I am, I have no fear to die. I die an innocent man. Truth is might and will prevail. I have done. Then the hood was put over his head and the noose over that. From beneath the heavy white sheet, the crowd of 400 could hear Jim Tracy quietly praying between sobs. At 2 o'clock, the order was given, the executioner pulled the trap door, and Jim Tracy fell through. His spine was snapped by the drop, and his body left to hang for 20 minutes. Then, it was lowered, and the doctors were given the okay to try to revive him. In 1893, the Chicago World's Fair would begin, and Nikola Tesla would amaze onlookers with his alternating current while H.H. Holmes tortured and killed dozens in his secret murder mansion. But that September afternoon, 11 years before the White City was built, three physicians combined the best of both worlds. In the bathroom of the old Cook County Jail, doctors Danforth, Bowers, and Haynes set about a procedure that looked quite a bit like Aldini had tried or Ure had attempted, but with the electrical sophistication 60 years of innovation had brought. An electric pole was secured to Tracy's spine while a series of long, wired needles were stabbed through his chest and plugged directly into his heart. When the electrical current was turned on, Tracy's limp body became taut. His arms swung, his legs kicked, his face contorted and squeezed, smiled and grimaced. This was all eminently predictable, of course, and no different from the other electrified criminals from decades before. There was, however, one important difference. Unlike Forster and Clydesdale, it wasn't just Tracy's limbs and face that started. It was also his heart. The holy grail of galvanic resurrection, right here, in the bathroom of a Chicago jail cell. It would take a further 17 years for Jean-Louis Prevost and Frederick Batelli to formally discover defibrillation at the University of Geneva in 1899, and it would take until 1947 for the first person, a 14-year-old boy with a congenital heart defect, to be saved by the device. Nobody would ever bother to credit Doctors Danforth, Bowers, and Haynes, but that's probably not what the doctors were looking to accomplish anyway. The records of Jim Tracy's near resurrection are pretty sparse, but from what we do know, it seems unlikely that the experiment was undertaken with some grand medical purpose in mind. Why was Tracy's body subjected to this strange experiment 50 years after such things had gone out of fashion? To make our best guess, we need to go back to the record of Aldini's experiment on George Forster in 1803. After detailing Forster's trial, hanging, and electrocution, the Newgate calendar ended with a curious sidebar. It reads, "Note, an experiment was made on a convict named Patrick Redmond, who was hanged for a street robbery on the 24th of February, 1767, in order to bring him to life. It appeared that the sufferer had hung 28 minutes when the mob rescued the body and carried it to an appointed place, where a surgeon was in attendance to try the experiment, bronchotomy, which is an incision in the windpipe, and which in less than 6 hours produced the desired effect." Okay, let's pause for a second and make sure we're all on the same page. According to the author of the Newgate Report, and I can't find anything else to corroborate this for what it's worth, 36 years before Aldini attempted his electrical resurrection on Forster, a different doctor tried and, what's more, succeeded in resuscitating an executed criminal by means of cutting open an airway below the noose. I have no idea if this is possible or not. The knee-jerk reaction is to say, no way. But I don't think we can rule it out that easily. Remember that to the people examining Patrick Redmond, "Is he breathing?" would have been the only question worth asking to determine whether he was dead or not. The perfect version of a hanging breaks the victim's neck, but in the real world, they often fell short of that ideal. Could Patrick Redmond have had his windpipe crushed by the noose but not his spine snapped? Could he have survived so meekly for half an hour that those who examined him believed he was dead? And could he have been rescued by an experimental bronchotomy? I don't know. But in my absolutely inexpert opinion, long shot though it may be, it doesn't sound entirely impossible. But the important thing about the story of Patrick Redmond comes next. After he was revived, quote, "A collection was made for the poor fellow, and interest made to obtain his pardon, for it will be remembered that the law says the condemned shall hang until he be dead. Consequently, men who, like Redmond, recovered, were liable to be again hanged up until they were dead." So after being executed once by the state and brought back, the officials urged that he not be hung again. Because that's kind of an open question, huh? The condemned shall hang until he be dead. All right. Well, he be'd dead for a little while, at least. So was Patrick Redmond's sentence served? Apparently the people attending to him thought so. There's no evidence to be found of why the doctors or courts or people of Chicago were concerned about their own Patrick Redmond paradox, but the execution of Jim Tracy seems to have had that worry in mind. Jim Tracy's neck was broken by the noose, so there was never any risk of having to re-execute him or set him free. But, as the report of the experiment concludes, it is probable that a considerable proportion of the criminals who are executed in this country are either mechanically strangled, that is, choked to death, or killed by shock that is made on the nervous system. In other words, the neck is not broken, and the spinal cord is not lacerated. In such cases, we are of the opinion that resuscitation would not be impossible, that electricity, frictions, artificial respirations, the hot bath, and other well-known means of resuscitation might result in resuscitating the criminal. If such a case would occur, would it not be the duty of the proper officials to repeat the execution? Would that be their duty? Or would the prisoner, the sentence having been passed, be free to go? It's a conundrum, all right. A conundrum which, 39 years later, gave Sam Cardinelli an idea. On January 17, 1920, the Volstead Act went into effect, making alcohol illegal throughout the country. In a few years' time, Prohibition would give the city of Chicago some of its most infamous names: Bugs Moran, Dean O'Banion, and, of course, Al Capone. While the roots of American organized crime were set down in Sicily, and New York did its fair bit of incubating, it's in Chicago that the Italian mafia really came into its own, through bootlegging, protection rackets, and basically anything they could get their hands on. But in 1920, the syndicate is still just a twinkle in Capone's syphilitic eye. Before organized crime found speakeasies, it was, well, less organized, but still pretty brutal. In Chicago, and most of the other cities that Italian immigrants were coming to, the thing to be scared of wasn't the mafia, but the Black Hand. In truth, there was no Black Hand, per se. It wasn't a wide-ranging single organization, but rather some untold number of small, unconnected gangsters that operated with a similar method. If you were an Italian in Chicago in the early 1900s and you opened a business, you'd soon receive a letter demanding you pay out a cut or face the consequences. And the signature at the bottom would be the frightening fabled image, a black hand. If you ignored the letter, your business would be bombed. If you still refused to pay after that, the Black Hand gangs would start picking off your family members, maybe your wife or one of your children, until you finally got the point. There were hundreds of Black Hand gangs throughout America in the early 20th century, from New York to New Orleans, Philadelphia to San Francisco, Scranton to Detroit. In 1907, a Black Hand training camp was raided by police in the tiny village of Hillsville, Pennsylvania. In Chicago alone, there were who knows how many Black Hand gangs. One for every Italian neighborhood, at the least. And there were a lot of Italian neighborhoods in early 20th century Chicago. Little Italy, Natch, Heart of Italy, Double Natch, Blue Island, Highwood, or the neighborhood they called Little Hell, which is now known as Cabrini Green. Wait, no, it's not. Cabrini Green is gone, too. What do we call that neighborhood now? I honestly don't know. Something marketing-friendly and terribly gentrified, no doubt. Anyway, of all the Black Hand gangs in all the country, the worst of them operated in Chicago, in what's now Chinatown, out of a pool hall at 22nd and Wentworth, owned by Sam Cardinelli. Cardinelli had a way of luring in wayward boys and enticing them into a life of violence and crime. They sent out Black Hand extortion letters. They made stick-ups and muggings and beatings and burglaries. Cardinelli would instruct his boys on where to go and what to hit, and then he'd take the lion's share of the profits. In the back room of the pool hall, he'd cheat the kids out of the rest of their earnings with crooked dice games. Worst of all, though, were the killings. Prosecutors would eventually pin 20 murders on the Cardinelli gang. They'd have probably been able to continue on killing, extorting, and stealing if they hadn't made the tiniest of mistakes. One night, the gang burst into a pool room on 63rd and held everyone there at gunpoint, relieving each and every last customer of their valuables. Except for one young man, Thomas Errico, who the crooks conspicuously passed by. After the robbery was over and the police arrived, witnesses related to them that Errico had been left alone. Everybody had figured out why. Errico was an inside man for the Cardinelli gang. Errico sang like a canary. Up until he was arrested, police didn't even know that there was a Cardinelli gang, but now they were privy to all kinds of grisly details. More importantly, Errico told the fuzz where to find his fellow gangsters, and soon the CPD had more than a dozen of his confederates in their clutches. Cardinelli himself wasn't among them, but his boys were all too happy to give him up and finger him as the ringleader for their every last shoplift. Cardinelli was a cruel and unforgiving crime boss, known to double-cross his underlings at the drop of a hat, and faced with lengthy rap sheets, those underlings finally decided they'd had enough of him. With the capture of Sam Cardinelli and his gang, Chicago police were suddenly able to close over 250 open cases. And soon enough, Sam and 14 of his associates were sentenced to die. Right here, at the old Cook County Jail. The first to meet the news was Nick the choir boy Viana, who earned his nickname by singing in his church choir. During the time he was imprisoned, he sang regularly for the inmates and guards, who reported he had the best voice any of them had ever heard. He was still singing as he was taken from his cell to the gallows on December 10th, 1920. Il Trovatore. When he finished, he shouted to his fellow inmates, "Goodbye and good luck, boys. Goodbye to all but Sam Cardinelli. May his soul be damned." He then told reporters, "All I want is that Cardinelli hang. That's what he deserves." Then he was taken to the noose, where the hood was placed, the trap thrown, the neck snapped. It was his 19th birthday. The residents and workers of the old Cook County Jail appreciated Viana's presence almost as much as they loathed Cardinelli's. He scared the other prisoners and disturbed the guards. The chief doctor waxed that if he were a little more superstitious, he'd say Cardinelli was possessed by Satan. As it happened, not having sung himself in any church choirs as such, Cardinelli had earned that very nickname, Il Diavolo, the devil. Today, we'd call Cardinelli a sociopath, but at the time, the devil had to do. But his character entirely changed after Viana died. He stopped eating, grew despondent and short, pacing constantly around his cell. When his wife and children came to visit him on April 14th, 1921, the night before his scheduled execution, the cold-hearted devil was a blubbering mess. He keened and wailed at his family in Italian. None of the guards present could make out what he was saying, except for one word that he repeated several times. A name. Viana. The next day, Sam Cardinelli fretfully argued that he should have an extra hour of life, given daylight savings time and all, and was granted this very brief reprieve. He refused to take a last meal, just as he had been refusing most food for the last 4 months. All in all, he'd lost something to the tune of 40 pounds in less than half a year. At 10 o'clock, the final order was given for Cardinelli to be brought to the gallows. He broke down, screaming and crying at the feet of the priests attending him. He was so distraught that he couldn't be raised back to his feet. He soiled himself right there on the floor of his cell. Finally, the guards had to pick him up, tie him to a chair, and carry him to his fate, seated and sniveling. On the platform, he still wouldn't stand, and so his chair was put over the trap door with him tied to it. Then the door was slid open, and down came Cardinelli, chair and all. His neck didn't break, So the small crowd of onlookers watched as, for 6 minutes, the devil strangled to death. Then the body was untied and given over to an ambulance to be brought to the funeral parlor, in accordance with Sam and his family's wishes. The deed was done. The devil was dead. "Except, wait," said one of the guards. "Didn't that lady in the ambulance look kinda like a nurse? And didn't that undertaker seem more like a doctor?" The warden, suspicious, ordered that the body be removed from the ambulance and taken by funeral car to the morgue directly. When they opened up the ambulance, they were faced with a peculiar sight. The nurse appeared to be warming the cadaver, and the doctor was about to poke some strange sort of needle into Sam Cardinelli's inanimate chest. When they searched the ambulance, they found that the mortuary bed had been lined with hot water bottles, an oxygen tank, and a giant electrical battery. If Sam Cardinelli had been brought back to life in front of his jailers, there might have been some question about whether he should be executed again or re-imprisoned. But if he managed to be revived in secret, all those difficult problems would evaporate. Everything about Sam Cardinelli's late-life personality was calculated to get him out of prison, dead, and then alive again. He had refused to eat in order to make himself lighter, refused to stand to make himself lower, all so that he wouldn't break his neck when the switch was thrown. And why had the guards heard him saying Vianna to his wife the night before? Years later, the rumors got back to the head doctor of the Cook County Jail. Cardinelli had probably heard about Jim Tracy 40 years ago and the conclusion of the doctors that he might have been resurrected if not for the spinal injury. But Cardinelli needed a test subject, and Nick, the choir boy Vianna, was just the ticket. After he sang and cursed Cardinelli, and after the hangman's noose, Vianna was taken in the same rigged mortuary basket as Cardinelli to an undertaker's office, where the team of proto-mob doctors attempted to revive him, and where, according to the rumors, they had succeeded. Vianna had opened his eyes, made some quiet, confused sound, and then died again. But Cardinelli's people had never intended on keeping Vianna alive anyway, so they took this moment of pseudo-life as a good proof of concept. Were they right? Was Cardinelli onto something? Could he have gotten away with it if only the warden hadn't stopped the ambulance? I don't know. Maybe. The authorities were apparently concerned enough that after the plot was discovered, they instituted a new policy, holding the bodies of the executed on site for several hours before releasing them to friends and family, just to be sure. And 7 years later, the state of Illinois gave up on hanging criminals anyway. In 1928, they replaced the gallows with the electric chair. Music for today's episode by Blue Dot Sessions, Lee Rose Vare, Kevin MacLeod, and Anime is Trash. I'm deeply indebted to two sources in particular for this episode, Andy Dugan and William Griffith. Dugan's book is called Raising the Dead, The Men Who Created Frankenstein. And had I discovered it earlier, it would have made my research for this story 10 times easier and 1,000 times more entertaining. It's an amazing, riveting catalog of all the various tripfalls and travails of the many eccentric madmen and geniuses who tried to electrocute people back to life, and damn, it's good. It's real good. Go check it out. William Griffith's book is Fatal Drop, True Tales of the Chicago Gallows, and if you're the kind of weirdo who wants to read about every miscreant and ne'er-do-well to ever be hung in Chicago, and if you're not that kind of person, what the hell are you doing here, this is the book for you. Finally, special thanks to the voice talent for today's episode.
Vance Smith.
Phil Ritterelli.
Heather Chrysler.
Until next time, from the old Cook County Courthouse, where in 1924, Leopold and Loeb were tried for the crime of the century, and Clarence Darrow gave a 12-hour plea to the court on their behalf, arguing, both successfully and correctly, that the death penalty is evil, useless, and fucking stupid. This has been The Constant.
Hey, Cordelia. How you doing? Hey, look at you, Cordelia. All right.
Come on, Cordelia. 1, 2, 3, 4. And 1, 2, 3, 4. Stay with me now.
Cordelia? Hey, kid. Look at you.